Okay, welcome you all. Pranam to each one of you, and welcome to our second meeting of our weekly exploration on the Srimad Bhagavatam. The living heart of the Srimad Bhagavatam, a journey into its essential message. So let's begin with some short Mangalacharan, as we somehow established spontaneously last week, to choose this beautiful composition by Srila Bhaktirakshar Dev Goswami Maharaj, which describes how Sri Gadadhar Pandit Sri Radha herself in Gaurlila is pouring the wine, intoxicating wine of Bhagavad Gata into the ears of Mahaprabhu, cup-like ears, and bringing him back to life after having him fainting because of hearing the Bhagavatam. Now he's returning because of the Bhagavatam, and so on and so forth. So in this Pranam mantra, I think everything is included. Radha and Krishna are included. Gaur Gadai, Mahaprabhu, Gaur Lila, Bhagavatam, Guru Tattva, since Radha is the ultimate Guru. Krishna is the Adi Guru, but Radha is Krishna's Guru. So it's a very comprehensive way of gathering blessings for each one of our meetings. Nilam Bodhitate Sadaswa Bidaha Kepam Bitam Bandhavam Srimad Bhagavati Katamadiraya Sanjeevayam Bhatiya Srimad Bhagavatam Sada Sanayana Ashrupayanai Pujayam Goswami Pravaro Gadadhar Vibhor Bhuyatmade Kadgati. Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Gadadhar ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrind ki jai, Gaur Pramanand Hari Bol. So again, Pranam, greetings to all from Ananda Ashram in North Carolina. And part two, introduction part two of our Srimad Bhagavatam exploration. So I always like to begin any meeting just a very, very brief recap of what we saw last week, last Monday, where we started our series by focusing on which is the intention, why we are doing this, and which will be the methodology for our study, just to briefly refresh those notions. So why we are doing this study, we spoke about Sankalpa, or the intention, the intentionality behind it, at least from my side, announcing it, and hopefully for you to participate. Well, why not to do it? The Srimad Bhagavatam is the central text of the Gaudiya Vaishnava tradition. It's a book, or as we will see, it's more than a book even, that has shaped our entire lineage, and that Mahaprabhu himself embraced in a unique way, he relished in a unique way, he extended the gift of that in a unique way, and here we are as a byproduct of that. So somehow, hopefully, this series will be an invitation to reconnect directly with that living source. And in that connection, of course, we also mentioned how for some, there may be some healing necessary, some to rediscover the text, to reapproach the text in a way that is wholesome, that is relatable, because some devotees have approached the Bhagavatam with mixed feelings, sometimes inspired, sometimes confused, sometimes overwhelmed, sometimes even hurt or traumatized, unfortunately, by how certain passages were presented or were explained to them. So one goal among many of the series will be to help rediscover the text in a way that is accurate, nourishing, spiritually healing, and more. And in terms of the methodology, well, as we clarify, rather than going verse by verse once a week for the next three centuries, that will be how much it will take, we'll follow a thematic approach or a golden thread approach, as we have baptized it, right? Bringing together key verses, key narratives and teachings, and trying to reveal, as the title suggests, the living heart of the Bhagavatam, the essential message. So we can relish, we can serve it, no? Perpetually. To relish something is not just a selfish, self-centered experience, but we are committed to serve and to love that. So, of course, for this to be the case, as I mentioned last week, our first month, if not more than that, we'll see, will be an introduction before we officially begin with the Bhagavatam, though hopefully by this point you already feel we have begun already in so many ways. So the introduction's intention is trying to understand how to read the book before we even dare to open it, how to establish proper groundwork, foundation, so whatever is built upon that is sustainable. So today is part two of the introduction, and we will be concentrating on which is the actual golden thread of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We have been talking a lot last class about the golden thread. So what's the golden thread? And I left you with insomnia for a whole week because I didn't reveal which is the golden thread, though I trust you know which is. But today we will be officially addressing that. And that was part of the homework, right? We share with you to reflect on what's the golden thread of the Bhagavatam and what's the golden thread that you need to find in the Bhagavatam, in the context of the golden thread in itself, right? So I'll be talking, as I already mentioned, part of the structure will be I'll be talking for about an hour-ish, and then we will open the space for questions that for the sake of time and conciseness will be sent. You are invited to send via written form in the chat of Zoom. You can send that to me, ideally via private message. If you don't know how to do it, you share in the group message, but start with an interrogation mark, so when I dive into that chat, I can figure out where are the questions. But that will be at the end. So first we'll be sharing for an hour or so, and then time for any quest and exploration. So, meeting number two, again, the golden thread of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Last class also, if you remember, we briefly referred to the Vedanta Sutra, and the Bhagavatam is said to be the essence of Vedanta, Sarva Vedanta Sar. And we have the first sutras of the Vedanta Sutra, which are said to be the essence of the Vedanta Sutra in its own way, in their own way, that invite, as you may recall, to inquire into Brahman, Atato Brahma Jignasa. What's Brahman? That which expands and makes everyone expand, the source of everything, Janmadi Asyajata, next aphorism. So how to know about the source of everything, this ever-expanding Brahman, third aphorism, Shastra Yonitvat. Shastra will be the womb through which knowledge of Brahman will come. And then how to navigate the jungle of sounds that Shastra is? That's the next question. So that's the fourth aphorism that said, Tattu Samambayat, which means we have to approach Shastra in a way that is reconciling. Shastra has to be approached and understood through Samambaya, or reconciling the various apparently disconnected statements with the central core, with the central intention of the main purpose of revelation, the golden thread, right? So for us Gaudiya Vaishnavas, the Srimad Bhagavatam, in one sense, the Srimad Bhagavatam is the golden thread of all Shastra. We'll be talking more about that next week, the unique position of the Srimad Bhagavatam about among other Shastras and why that is so and how we justify that. So in one sense, the Srimad Bhagavatam as a scripture is the golden thread among other scriptures. But which is the golden thread of the Srimad Bhagavatam itself? That's the question we'll try to address today. Because as we already said, for many, still when approaching the book, we may feel confused, overwhelmed. That seems not to be a golden thread. For some, there seems not to be a coherent aligning of the different topics. So we'll try to show how that's actually the case. There is a very clear golden thread. But before speaking which is the golden thread, as usual, we need to begin with some via negativa, with some neti-neti, which is not the golden thread, which may have been the so-called golden thread for many of us for a few decades. Hopefully not. And I will throw a few examples. Of course, there are so many. If there's one golden thread, there are so many potential apparent golden threads which are not. So I will just brief a few of them. I don't know. Is the earth flat or not? Right? Some people get caught into that and think, okay, that's the whole thing of the Bhagavatam. We have to figure that out. That's what the Bhagavatam is about. That's not the golden thread, friends. Sorry. We can talk about that. Of course, there's place for all of this conversation, but let's not absolutize that to the point of making that the golden thread. Whether the sun revolves around the earth or the other way around, cosmological considerations, that's not the golden thread of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Sorry, guys. If you were expecting to just dive deep into that for the next three centuries, that won't be the case. So you are free to go. That's there again, and those are sections that we need to address and understand why this is presented in this or that way, but that's not the golden thread. Or, I don't know, hellish planets. Are the hellish planets literally real, like are described in the Bhagavatam or not? And on top of that, will I be going to those hellish planets if I fail to chant my 16 rounds one day in my lifetime, if I do not become a perfect bhakti performer? Relax, right? That's not what the Srimad Bhagavatam's golden thread is about. Those are all sections that hopefully we will be addressing in the course of our exploration, but they do not constitute the golden thread. So those are a few examples just of what the Bhagavatam is not. Okay? Sometimes we need to dismantle and deconstruct false values, false beliefs, anartha, false value, anartha nibriti, before artha pravritti. So after this brief neti-neti, because to be honest, I could go on for hours with what the Bhagavatam's golden thread is not, but let's go to the real thing. So after this neti-neti, this knot, that knot, which is the golden thread of the Srimad Bhagavatam? So I've kept you awake for a whole week with this, so I'll reveal it right now, briefly. And as cliche as it may sound, the golden thread of the Srimad Bhagavatam is love. Yes, there's a lot to say about that four-letter word, but yeah, if we have to summarize in one English word, let's put it that way, love. More precisely, divine love. Even more precisely, a divine love that is not exclusionary. It's not divine love between God and me, so to say. It's inclusivistic. It's all-encompassing, as we have explained many other times. It's a divine love that is centered on the Sweet Absolute, but from there, it's embracing and loving everything in connection to the common center. Now, if I love God, I want to love whatever is connected to the divine, and everything is connected to the divine, and everything is loved by the divine. So that's the golden thread of the Bhagavatam, that type of divine love. And I'm still being generic and general. We will get into more specificity soon. Because, of course, there are nuances of this divine love. There are levels of intensity of divine love. For some may be too intense. There are levels of sweetness of divine love. But some people may get spiritual diabetes with too much sweetness in divine love. And there are options of divine love which do not have that much sugar content, so to say. And all of them have place in eternity. And the Bhagavatam will speak about all of them, while at the same time presenting some particular zenith according to the Gaudiya lenses. So there are different forms of love, and therefore there are different, because there are different lovers, right, that will choose their own favorite option among the endless options in the menu. Let's put it that way. But that's basically the golden thread of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Love, divine love, universal, all-encompassing divine love that will play itself out in very different and unique ways as the Bhagavatam itself will show throughout its pages. Of course, as I said many times, this golden thread is hinted in the very title of the book, Srimad Bhagavatam. Like when Mahaprabhu was traveling in South India and he found one illiterate Vaishnav who didn't know how to read. He was just looking at the cover of the Bhagavad Gita and crying profuse tears. And Mahaprabhu approached him, "Why are you crying? Oh, you are not even opening the book. You are just looking at the cover." And he said, "Yeah, because when I see this cover and I see Krishna, God himself, having become the devotee of his devotee, acting as a chariot driver of Arjuna, God being conquered by bhakti, by love, to the point that he becomes a lover of his lover, I cannot contain my tears." And Mahaprabhu started to cry with him and embrace him and say, "You have truly understood the essence of the Bhagavad Gita just by looking at the cover. You don't need to read the book. You got it." Pay attention to the cover of the books, just in case. And in this case, pay attention to the title of the book, Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a lot there. What's the meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam? And you may be familiar with one way of describing that, which is a very specific and deep way. We'll get there in a moment. But in a more general way, applied to us, to the jiva, to the atma and the potential of the atman, Srimad Bhagavatam could refer to that beautiful. Sri could mean beautiful. Mad means madness. To that beautiful madness that occurs in relationship to Bhagavan. Srimad Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam means in relationship to Bhagavan. To Srimad, the beautiful madness that occurs in relationship to the personal God, Bhagavan. And this beautiful madness, of course, refers to not just going crazy in a negative way, but the madness of passionate love that a soul can develop in potential in relation to the sweet absolute, to the radically personal sweet absolute. So that's one way of reading Srimad Bhagavatam, and that's one way to see the golden thread of the Bhagavatam in its very title. The whole book is about the madness of divine love that each one of us are invited to embrace in connection to the divine. It's very similar to how you can get the glimpse of the golden thread of Chaitanya Charitamrita by its very title. Because Chaitanya Charitamrita, of course, could be translated as the nectarian qualities of Sri Chaitanya Dev, Mahaprabhu. But also if we take Chaitanya's consciousness, which is the meaning of Chaitanya, we could say Chaitanya Charitamrita means the immortal, or Amrita. Amrita means immortal and nectarian or mellifluous. The immortal character, Charit, of Chaitanya, of consciousness, in the nectar, Amrit, of divine love, that Mahaprabhu embodied to the extreme, of course. So just giving you a few examples for you to know, to see how it's all in the title. If you have the eyes to see, it's all in the title, it's all in the cover. Some of us, we need to open actually the book and go through the book. Still, we may not understand it. We need some explanation. It's fine not to feel bad about ourselves. But in principle, the golden thread is right there. And of course, Srimad Bhagavatam is also related to Sri Radha. We'll get there later today. That's a very zenith-like way of understanding this golden thread. Ultimately, the divine love that is the golden thread of the Bhagavatam culminates in the personification of divine love in the form of Sri Radha. But again, for a moment, I think let's stay with our own situation so it's relatable for us. Srimad Bhagavatam speaks about the soul's potential in bhakti. And how can we go crazy in divine love, in the good sense? Crazy is not a bad word, okay? So this is the golden thread. There you have it, of the Srimad Bhagavatam, divine love. Or in one word in Sanskrit, you could say bhakti also, of course. Bhakti. No? Because bhakti is not just sadhana bhakti. Bhakti is bhava bhakti. Bhakti is prema bhakti. Bhakti is bhakti rasa. All these different expressions of bhakti include the word bhakti. So golden thread, essential message, living heart, you name it as whatever, however it serves you better, bhakti. And whatever other topics we find in the Bhagavatam, they are there to directly or indirectly shed light on this main theme, on this golden thread. Because there will be an endless, parade of topics. And again, we can become bewildered. Wow, atomic theories, dynasties of kings, astronomical considerations, aesthetic perspectives, hellish descriptions. What's this book about? And then some other people say that the ultimately book is about one lady called Sri Radha, but she's not even mentioned once directly in the book. How to make sense of this whole thing? So whatever is in the Bhagavatam is pointing to this golden thread, bhakti. And whatever is said directly or indirectly is pointing in that direction. That's why the very first verse of the Bhagavatam, that we'll go there whenever we start officially to study that first verse, 1:1:1, basically starts saying that, right? Janma diyasyan jatan bayadi tarata charti subhignyasura. So it says, anvayat itarata, which means directly and indirectly, right? So that's the very point we are mentioning. All the apparent unrelated topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam are somehow shedding light directly or indirectly to the main theme. The apparently unrelated are shedding light indirectly, of course. Like in acting, you have like the supporting roles, the supporting actors. like are there to complement to the main actor, to the main role, to the main theme, to the main topic, to the main thread of the story. So the whole treatise revolves around a golden thread, and all the other topics are the other threads, the other sections, the other different ways of emphasis and perspectives are in service of the golden thread. We could speak about the one golden thread and many silver threads, right? Supporting the golden one. No? Like Bed Abed, it's always Bed Abed. No? Abed, unity in diversity. No? There is unity, one golden thread, and there is a diversity of silver threads that exist in harmony and service of the golden thread. No? So I'm trying to pound this post, and the whole class today will basically be the same, saying the same thing from as many angles as possible, so we can get somehow, hopefully at least in one way or more, this idea clear. So whenever we find something that seems to be disconnected, unrelated, we can understand, oh, this is a silver thread pointing to the golden thread. It's indirectly speaking about the main theme. And you may wonder at this point, but how do you know this is the case, Maharaj, from where you are bringing this noble theory? Is that your own invention? No. It's Srimad Bhagavatam's own revelation. This is found in the Bhagavatam itself. So in order to understand what the Bhagavatam is about, you need just to go to the Bhagavatam. So this is very clearly stated in the Srimad Bhagavatam when, in many ways, one of those when it mentions the main 10 topics of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So we'll go there next for a moment. And remember, we are not here, you are not following chronology. Now we are jumping to the second canto. We are not following chronology, we are following necessity. So we need to go there now. So let's go there. So if you have the book with you, or if you want to go to the database in case you want to have the verse in front of you, if not, I will check it. Second canto, chapter 10, verse number 1. 2:10:1. And there in this verse, the main tattvas, the 10 main tattvas, and tattva here means like reality, topic, principle. The main tattvas, 10 main tattvas of the Bhagavatam are shared. So I'll briefly recite the Sanskrit, then we will share the verse translation and try to see how the Bhagavatam itself is pointing to a golden thread and to another a whole variety of topics in the context of that. So verse 2:10:1, it's saying, Atra sargo visargascha stanam poshanam uttayah manvantare shanu kata nirodhumuktir asrayah. So the verse basically is enumerating 10 topics. No? We will go one by one now. 10 themes found here. No? The verse starts saying Atra. So Atra means here. And here means here in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So there are 10 main themes. So we'll go one by one briefly. First one is Sarga. So Sarga is primordial creation. The second one is Visarga, which is the secondary creation of forms within the universe. So more related to Brahma, doing something with the ingredients he's provided with. But the first one is the manifestation from the previous cycle of creation to the new one, and with the elements with which Brahma can do something. So those are the first two, very related to material creation, if you can pay attention to. Third one is sthana, which means sustenance, you pronounce in English, sustenance of life systems. Again, we are dealing with this world, biology, here and here, very grounded to begin with. Fourth one is poshana. Poshana means the operation of grace. Now I'm trying to translate them in ways that hopefully are clear to you. Fifth one is Uttayaha. So Uttaya means the creative impetus. Sometimes has been translated also as the matrix of phenomenality. And we will, again, eventually we'll get to find all these topics in the different cantos. So I'm not stopping here to analyze each one of them. The sixth one is Manvantara, or the governance of the various Manu dynasties, which somehow is connected to the example of these various pious kings, which represent the enactment of Dharma for those who are open to Dharma. Seventh, Isha Anukata, stories of Ishvara's various forms, like the different avatar descents of Bhagavan. We will find that in the Bhagavatam, Nrisimhadeva, Ramachandra, Varaha, Vamadeva, etc. Nirodha, the dissolution of life systems. Again, speaking about the cycles of creations, maintenance, dissolution, and so on and so forth. Then the ninth topic is liberation, mukti. We know what mukti is, to transcend, in general way, to transcend all illusion and entanglement, and be free, freedom, emancipation. And finally, number 10, and here we come to the golden thread, Ashraya. Ashraya means shelter. So Ashraya, it's interesting because it doesn't say bhakti, it doesn't say Krishna, it says Ashraya, which basically implies this one is the shelter and all the other topics are sheltered in this one. Srila Prabhupada will translate this, the ultimate shelter, as the summum bonum, the highest good. Okay, so these are 10 main themes of the Bhagavatam. Now, these are 10 classical main themes that are found in any major Purana. Just a few detailed technical clarification. And these same 10 themes have been again mentioned at the end of the Srimad Bhagavatam with slightly different words. You can see in 12, if you want, Canto 12, Chapter 7, Verses 9 and 10. Again, these 10 topics are mentioned with slightly different wording. And also in that verse, it is clarified, any major Purana, there are majors and smaller Puranas. Major Puranas have these 10 topics. Smaller Puranas, minor Puranas have 5 of these topics, of these 10 topics. Matsya Purana clarifies this. So the Srimad Bhagavatam is known sometimes as the Bhagavat Purana, and it includes the above 10 topics because it's a major Purana. So in this list that I just shared with you, in this verse of the Bhagavatam, the last, the 10th topic of the list is the Ashraya, is the golden thread of the Bhagavatam. That's how the Bhagavatam refers to it. It will not use the word golden thread, speaking in the terms of Ashraya. So in a list, if in a list you have something called Ashraya, means that's the shelter, and everything else takes shelter in that shelter. So the 10th topic is Ashraya. The other 9 topics are in Sanskrit called Ashrita. So Ashrita means those who take shelter in. Like when, I don't know. Well, that's interesting because the only example that comes to mind immediately is one in which Krishna is taking shelter in Yogamaya. Because we will talk in a moment, Krishna is supposed to be the Ashraya, but then you have the Ashraya taking Ashraya himself. At the beginning of Rasa Lila, right? Sukadev says, Yogamaya Upashrita. No. Bhagavan is taking Upashrita, full shelter in his Yogamaya Shakti. Anyhow, that's another conversation when we reach the Rasa Panchadhyaya, 5 chapters on Rasa Lila. So Ashraya means shelter. Ashraya means refuge. I like the word refuge. And Ashrita means sheltered or refugee. No? Sometimes we might think refugees of war only, right? But a refugee is one who takes refuge. So all the first nine topics find their shelter in the 10th topic, which is the Ashraya. So it's interesting because this golden thread, this 10th topic, is not mentioned directly as Krishna, but Ashraya. After having mentioned cosmical issues, as we saw, creation, dissolution, maintenance, dynasties of kings, even mukti. You know, for some people, it's like, okay, there's nothing else apart from mukti. And mukti is the end of it all. But then after mukti comes Ashraya. So in that sense, Ashraya means bhakti. We could read Ashraya as bhakti because 9th topic in the list is mukti. So what's after mukti? Bhakti. No? Bhakti is a post-liberated state. It's beyond mukti. Moksha laguta krit, Rupa Goswami will say. Bhakti doesn't care for mukti, with all respect to Mukti Devi and those who pursue her. Because sometimes we have said, and this is an important point, okay, the Ashraya, the main topic is Krishna, not bhakti. But my point is how much we can separate those two, right? Because every manifestation of Bhagavan appears in response to a certain type of bhakti. So if we speak about Krishna, we are speaking about the type of bhakti that corresponds with that form called Krishna. If we are speaking about Ramachandra, we are speaking about the type of Ram bhakti that corresponds to that form called Ram. No, that's said in the Bhagavatam. I don't want to jump too much to many verses now, but you go, if you don't believe me, Canto 3, Chapter 9, Verse 11. Tvam bhakti yoga paribhavita hritsaroja, etc. Sri Tekshito. Anyhow, that says, in that verse says, Bhagavan says, Brahma prays to Bhagavan, you adopt different forms according to how your devotees meditate upon you. So your form corresponds to bhakti. So if you want to say the Ashraya is Krishna, okay, but Krishna is exists in relationship to a certain type of bhakti. You cannot separate the two. And because the ninth topic is mukti, naturally the tenth topic is bhakti. And Krishna is inseparable from that. So that's the golden thread of the Bhagavatam. The Ashraya, the tenth topic in this list, is bhakti, which is sheltering everything else, including mukti. And of course, as we said already, there are endless expressions of bhakti, and there are endless expressions of Bhagavan, because if every form of Bhagavan corresponds to the type of bhakti, and there are endless forms of Bhagavan, as the Bhagavatam itself says, asankhya, uncountable, we have endless expressions of bhakti, of both bhakti and Bhagavan. And of course, for Gaudiya Vaishnavas, this is our Bhagavan, so to say, will be Bhagavan Sri Krishna, corresponding to the bhakti of Vrindavan. But that's our preference. The Srimad Bhagavatam will also present other varieties, other forms of Bhagavan, and other forms of bhakti in connection to that Bhagavan. Ramachandra will be there, and Hanuman's bhakti will be there in connection to that. There will be Vishnu bhaktas. And all of them are Ashraya also in this list, just to be non-sectarian. It's not that the Ashraya of Bhagavatam is Krishna and Vrindavan and Braja bhakti of the gopis, and everything else is not Ashraya. No. All the forms of bhakti and all the corresponding forms of Bhagavan in response to that bhakti, all of them enter into this word Ashraya, which is the golden thread of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So whenever the Srimad Bhagavatam talks about the first nine topics that I just mentioned, whether it is creation, dissolution, cosmic stuff, kings, different narratives, it's all in the context of them being supporting roles, going back to the example of the main actor in the drama, Ashraya, bhakti, divine love. And this is very clearly emphasized in the Bhagavatam right after these 10 topics were shared, no? In the first verse of the 10th chapter of the second canto. The next verse, immediately after that, 2.10.2, basically there says, to clearly establish the meaning of the 10th subject, Ashraya, the great souls describe here the characteristics of the other nine, using both scriptural testimony and direct reasoning. So all the description that the Mahatmas, as the verb refers to, all the description about the other nine topics are there to clearly establish the main topic, the 10th subject, Ashraya, the golden thread. In the Indian system of Nyaya or logic, they will call this Saka Chandra Nyaya. Like, if I'm with you, Saka means branch and Chandra means moon. And Nyaya means like logic or maxim. So if I'm with you and you want to see the moon, but for whatever reason you cannot find the moon, but I'm seeing the moon, so I will give you a point of reference for you to look in certain there. I will say, do you see that branch of this tree nearby? Yes. Okay, just now move a little bit upward and there's the moon. Oh. So my point was not to make you just become obsessed with the branch. We want you to see the moon. So in the same way, all these different topics of the Bhagavatam that are not the Ashraya are like the branch, are like there to point to their shelter, to the Ashraya. Let me give you a few examples of how this takes place in the Bhagavatam, so we can have a more concrete idea. As I say before, many of the topics in the above list are related to material creation. And how, therefore, to see material creation in connection to the Ashraya, to Bhakti, to God, to the Divine. As we will see when we begin the first, our study of the Bhagavatam more officially, so to say, first canto onward, many times when a session between teacher and student begins, and the students ask some question about something, many times the first answer that comes, even if it's the question is not about that, the first answer is in relation to the Bishvarup, to see the universe as a form of God. Interesting. Even if the question was not about that, you will see when Parikshit Maharaj asked from Sukadeva Goswami, he starts describing the Bishvarup. Parikshit Maharaj never asked about the Bishvarup. But he started to talk about material creation. But in a context that we can see the divine right here, right now, in nature. So we can see matter as sacred. That's right there in the Bhagavatam. First, we have to be grounded in that. In yogic terms, I will say, first have your Muladhara chakra in place. First have your foundation well established. Muladhara chakra is the lowest chakra. Lowest, not in a bad sense. Have that in place. Don't try to jump to the Sahasrara chakra. You may have some dysfunctional psychic situation. Have your Muladhara chakra in place. First have your foundation. Then we can speak about other things. Let's be grounded. Let's be radical. Radical means let's go to the root. Properly rooted. So Bhagavatam begins like that. Speaking about some of these first nine topics. Creation, dissolution, maintenance of the cosmos. All in connection to God. Pointing to the Ashraya. Another of these nine first topics is the depictions of kings and dynasties, right? And interestingly enough, in the conclusion of the Bhagavatam, Sukadeva Goswami tells Parikshit, in connection to these descriptions, in the 12th canto, chapter 3, verse 14, I have it here, say, I have related to you the narrations of all these great kings who spread their fame throughout the world and then departed. My real purpose was to teach detachment from and insight into the temporal nature of material grandeur. Stories of kings lend power and opulence to these narrations, but do not in themselves constitute the ultimate aspect of knowledge. They are just a display of rhetoric. They are not the ultimate truth. So again, there is Sukadeva Goswami making that clear to Parikshit. Yeah, we talk a lot about kings with this purpose. This is the context. And then the next verse after that contrasts this whole thing with hearing about Krishna in bhakti. Or even in the beginning, in the forest of Naimisharanya, right? We will get there eventually. But there are the sages in Naimisharanya, and Sutta Goswami comes, and they express to Sutta Goswami, we are very interested in hearing from you. Even we are interested in hearing from you about the story of the king Parikshit, again, a king, Krishna's grandnephew. But the sages in Naimisharanya say, we're interested in hearing about stories of kings only if doing so is a basis for stories about Krishna. So bring all the kings you want, as much as that connects us with the Ashraya. No? You can find that in 1st Canto, chapter 16, verse 5 and 6. I'm trying to provide all the references. In other words, whatever gets in the way of this should be dealt properly and not should be absolutized to the point of relativizing the zum bonum, the Ashraya, the main theme. So a few examples of how we can see all these first nine tattvas or main topics of the Bhagavatam existing in relation to sheltered by in the service of the 10th topic, the Ashraya, the summum bonum, the golden thread of the Bhagavatam, bhakti, and Krishna, the unique Krishna in connection to that unique bhakti. Another way to speak about Ashraya and Ashrita, the shelter and the sheltered, refuge and refugees, comes in a section of the Padma Purana. Let's go for a moment to the Padma Purana, which is quite complementary in many ways to the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in the Padma Purana, we find a series of verses that refers to the Srimad Bhagavatam as non-different from Krishna. We have many of these non-different manifestations, right? The name of Krishna, Murti, the deity, the Bhagavatam, the Dham in its own way, and so on. So this verse speaks about the Bhagavatam as an incarnation of Krishna, right? Granta Bhagavat. And it starts to define the different cantos of the Bhagavatam in connection to different limbs of Krishna's body, trying to make the parallel. This, and Krishna is his body, right? We say we are not his body, but Krishna is his body, because there is no difference between Krishna's form and essence. So all the cantos are related to different forms of that body who is non-different from Krishna. And therefore, the Bhagavatam is non-different from Krishna. So the Padma Purana, for example, says canto 1 and 2 are the lotus feet of Krishna. Again, let's begin grounded. And let's build from there, from the foundation. Cantos 3 and 4 are Krishna's thighs. Thighs, you pronounce? Yeah. Canto 5 is Krishna's navel. Canto 6 is Krishna's chest. Canto 7 and 8 are Krishna's arms. Canto 9 is Krishna's neck. Canto 10 is Krishna's smiling face. Not only face, smiling face. Well, Krishna's always smiling. Canto 11 is Krishna's forehead. And Canto 12 is Krishna's head. So that's an interesting depiction. As you can see, the central part is the smiling face, right? If I'm not seeing your face smiling, I don't care for your arm, for your feet, for your navel, with all respect to all those limbs. I want to see your smiling face. So Krishna, for us, that's the central part. Canto 10, of course. Canto 10 of the Bhagavatam is all about Krishna Lila. All about the particular form of God, the particular form of bhakti that for us is the asraya of all asrayas. So the central part is the smiling face. Krishna in Braj, and that particular love that makes him smile uniquely. But that say, the first 9 cantos are other bodily limbs that come before the face, right? First 9 cantos sustain the face, right? You cannot just have a face without something sustaining it, okay? So they include the necessary foundation for the face to be there and for the face to smile. Then comes the 10th canto, the smiling face, which is, again, clearly the essence of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And no wonder our Goswami's books mostly are centered around the 10th canto. Even when they comment of the Bhagavatam, most of their commentaries are only about the 10th canto, with a few exceptions. And then we have canto 11 and 12, interestingly, because some may ask, well, if the 10th canto is the zenith, why do we need a 10 and a canto 11 and 12? Because we need an afterthought about so much that happened in the 10th canto, like the appendix to the book, to further reflect and make full sense of what just happened there. So the remaining 2 cantos are more head-like, right? 11th canto forehead, 12th canto head. So it implies we will be thinking, we will be ruminating, we will be reflecting back, an afterthought of, what just happened in that 10th canto? Such a wild, passionate display of unique love. So let's try to philosophically make sense of that as much as we can. We don't want to limit heart affairs to the head. But let's try to make philosophical sense as much as we can of such a festival of love. So that's the purpose of canto 11 and 12. So as you can see, each canto is compared to a limb in the body. The 10th canto represents Krishna Lila, clearly, or the Asraya Tattva in our above list. Try to keep the connection between these two. And this 10th canto is compared to Krishna's smiling face. As I say, we can live without feet, we can live with dead hands, but we cannot live without a face, right? And especially without a smiling face. Because if we cannot find enough reasons to smile at every moment, even in the difficult moments, still there is hope and a reason to smile. If we don't find that there, I wonder how much we are living a truly real life. Bhagavatam will use the expression atmaha. You are breathing, but life is not there. So the first 9 cantos are building the foundation for us to gradually get to that smiling lotus face of Krishna, who smiles in a unique way out of love in Vrindavan. And the project for us, when we reach that lotus face, that lotus smile, for us to become a bumblebee, attracted to the pollen and nectar of that lotus flower, entering into that pollen till the lotus flower closes at night and we become trapped there forever. And our acharyas will say the opposite happens in the same way. Krishna considers himself a bumblebee, like you can see in the Brahma Gita. He enters into the lotus heart of the devotee, the lotus closes, and he becomes their trap forever. So, the first nine topics, going back to the list of 10 topics, the first nine topics, including stories of great devotees, of kings, their teachings, accounts of different avatars of Vishnu and their teachings, all of them are covered in the cantos 1 to 9 and 11 to 12, right? And the 10th canto is reserved for Krishna Lila. And the 10th canto is one quarter of the whole Srimad Bhagavatam. It's way bigger than all the other cantos. So it's clearly the main section, clearly the Ashraya. So this is the golden thread of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And someone may ask, right? Someone may ask, okay, if Krishna is that important, Braja Krishna in particular, and for that we need to bring Radha into the picture, and Vrindavan and the bhakti of Vrindavan, if all of this is the actual essence and the golden thread, why all this was not clearly stated in the Vedas or in texts prior to the Vedas, like Vedanta Sutra and Upanishads? And our answer will be, and it's not my answer, that's what Vyasa himself say, will say, well, that was Vyasadeva's mistake, right? Shortcoming. He says that. We are not saying that. He's saying that. According to his own opinion, he feels at one point, and that will be told in the Bhagavatam itself. We will reach there eventually. At the very beginning of the Bhagavatam, Vyasa is frustrated, basically. He's having some sort of existential crisis because he feels not totally fulfilling his literary contribution to the world. Imagine being Vyasa and feeling unfulfilled. Such a paradox. And then his guru, Narad Muni, appears on the scene and chastises him in the Bhagavatam. This is all recorded. And Vyasa has no problem sharing his own embarrassing situation. That's humbling to all of us as well. So that's very glorious in itself. We need to be transparent about our life journey. And then Narad Muni is telling Vyasa, you have not made clear what's the actual golden thread of this Shastra. That's why you need to rewrite the Bhagavatam, because Vyasa had compiled the first version of the Bhagavad Purana, and Bhakti was not as clear as it is in the version we know now. So that's why the Bhagavatam has to be rewritten or re-edited as we know it today. We'll see more of this in the next class and other classes. But the main mistake, if you want to use that word, from Vyasa was that he didn't emphasize Bhakti enough. And more precisely, we will say that he didn't emphasize the unique bhakti of Braj, the unique form of God that manifests in response to that unique form of love and bhakti. That the Bhagavatam, as we know it, clearly emphasizes, dedicating this, not only the whole 10th canto to it, but dropping so many other hints before that and after that. The main line, in one sense, for us of the Bhagavatam being Krishna stu Bhagavan Swayam. And I will add as a Gaudiya Vaishnav, Braja Krishna stu Bhagavan Swayam. Because there are many Krishnas also in the Bhagavatam. Krishna in Mathura, Krishna in Dwarka, Krishna in Kurukshetra, Krishna in Hastinapur. But as a Gaudiya Vaishnav, again, we are addressing it from the Gaudiya perspective. It's Braja Krishna stu Bhagavan Swayam. That Krishna is when Bhagavan becomes Swayam, when Bhagavan becomes himself, he is Krishna. And that happens in Vrindavan. When God rests from the throne and the crown and all that heavy stuff, and he can just be himself in the fullness of informality, barefoot in the forest of Vrindavan, full intimacy. That corresponds with Braja Krishna, not even with Krishna Mathura in Dwarka. So that said, Okay, we will say, okay, so the Bhagavatam, in the Bhagavatam, Vyasadev made it clear bhakti is the golden thread. And bhakti, and Krishna, in response to that bhakti, is another form of Dasraya. Why the book is not called Krishna Purana? And it's called the Bhagavat Purana. Bhagavat is related to Bhagavan, which in one sense is a more generic notion than saying Krishna. Why? Because the book is not only about Krishna. Again, we will see that's the Asraya, that's the zenith for us as Gaudiyas. But the Asraya, as I say before, the golden thread or the shelter of the book is Bhagavan and is bhakti in a general way. For some, it will be some form of Bhagavan and some form of bhakti. For us, it's a certain form of Bhagavan and a certain form of bhakti. But for us, maybe another form. And that's why the book is named Bhagavat Purana. Because the book is about bhakti for Bhagavan in all the forms it takes. It's inclusive. Satyam Param Dimahi, invitation to meditate in the absolute truth. So Vyasa chose this name. Because again, despite there is for us as Gaudiyas a clear unfolding and a clear zenith in the Bhagavatam, at the same time, Srimad Bhagavatam points to the universality of the Bhagavatam, which is inclusive, not exclusive. So there are ways to understand this golden thread, this bhakti, this love, and the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is a love story, in both universal and specific ways. We can drill in very specifically to our particular way of understanding it, as I will show you now, but we can also see that the Bhagavatam is talking about relationship to other forms of the Absolute. Let me give you an example. And bear with me a few more moments as I transgress my 1 hour period today for a few minutes. So in very general terms, we could say that the Ashraya Tattva of the Bhagavatam, the shelter, the golden thread is the Absolute. That could be a very generic way of saying that's the summum bonum, the Absolute. And the Bhagavatam says, Brahmeti Paramatmeti Bhagavan iti shabdyate. That the ultimate truth, that ultimate tattva can be Brahman Paramatma Bhagavan. It's the same non-dual absolute. And for some, the absolute will be Brahman. And there you will find a few statements in the Bhagavatam that address those who have a taste for Brahman. Though it's clear that the Bhagavatam is not, its main emphasis is not Brahman and Brahman Sayuja. But you will find sections where Asad Advaitin you'll find at home. And that's why some Advaitins read the Bhagavatam through their own lenses. So in a very general way, you could say the golden thread, the Ashraya, Tattva of the Bhagavatam is the Absolute. That could be Brahman. That could be Paramatma. We will feel, though, that's Bhagavan for us. Okay. But still, for some, Bhagavan could refer to Narayan, Vishnu, which is depicted a lot in the Bhagavatam. Before the 10th canto, if you pay close attention, before the 10th canto, every time God appears into the scene to receive prayers, to offer blessings, almost always is Narayan, four-armed Chaturbhuj Vishnu, if you pay attention. So that's very present in the Bhagavatam. And then, of course, you have many forms of Bhagavan described throughout the Bhagavatam, Narsimhadev, Bhamandev, Barahadev, Ramachandra, Matsya Kurma, and so on, Parasuram. So Bhagavan, yeah, they're all Bhagavan. They are depicted a lot in the Bhagavatam, and many of those forms are quite Aishwarya-like because the Bhagavatam is making a case. So it's building a foundation, and sometimes you need to have some ground of Aishwarya before you can understand Madhurya, before you can understand the intimacy of Vrindavan, where God doesn't look like God, and when he looks, seems to be behaving in ways that seem to be immoral even. So how to understand all that properly? The Bhagavatam builds a foundation in the first 9 cantos, and then you have an afterthought in the last 2 cantos to make sure that you properly got 10th canto right. Okay? So first 9 cantos preparing the ground, last 2 cantos an afterthought to make sure that you didn't misread what Krishna Lila is about, especially in Vrindavan, which can be quite bewildering for many. As you see in the Krishna Lila, in the 10th canto, for Brahma, for Indra, for these great personalities, they don't get Krishna in Vrindavan that easily. So the Bhagavatam is building all this, speaking about God, Vishnu, Narayan. But again, for us as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, and for other Krishna Bhakti Vaishnava lineages, the Ashraya Tattva is not Brahman, not Paramatma, not Bhagavan, Vishnu, Narayan, with all respect to all that, but we will feel called to call the Ashraya Tattva is Krishna. Krishna is still Bhagavan Swayam. But again, the question, as I say before, is which Krishna? Right? Because the Bhagavatam speaks about Krishna in Hastinapur, Dwarka, Mathura, Kurukshetra, and many of these destinations are possible in eternity. So, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, our Ashraya Tattva is Braja Krishna. And of course, Braja Krishna is never alone. So it's a whole retinue around Braja Krishna that is part of the picture. Because as the title of the book suggests, again, Prabhupada will say Krishna is never alone and Krishna without Radha. Yeah, Krishna is the all-attractive, but without Radha next to him, I don't know if to call him the all-attractive. He's the all-attractive always, but with Radha next to him, he's the all-attractive. So the title of the book suggests Srimad Bhagavatam. Another name for Sri is Sri Radha. So we want both God and Goddess, Radha and Krishna. So our Ashraya Tattva, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, our golden thread in the Bhagavatam is a particular type of bhakti offered to the divine couple and to all the, again, paraphernalia and retinue in Braj. And even that will be in a particular way, as conceived and experienced by Mahaprabhu himself, and as he extended that gift to us in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. And that's a unique take found in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. And by this, I'm not saying we are better than anyone else, remember. We are not claiming all this to say, and therefore here we are the superior guys with the ultimate understanding of the Bhagavatam. No, this is our Ashraya Tattva, our golden thread of the Bhagavatam in the Gaudiya Sampradaya. That's our cup of tea. But there's also so many other options that will be ideal and the best for other people. And we are to appreciate that, all that as well. So I gave you this sequence for you to appreciate both the universality in the reach of the Bhagavatam and how we can think in universal terms about Ashraya, golden thread, but also the specificity of the Bhagavatam, and how for us, again, the very title itself speaks about Srimad Bhagavatam. Sri Radha, Mad, her madness of divine love in relation to Bhagavan, and how to serve that madness, how to serve the madness of love of the goddess in connection to the divine, masculine. That's our goal, or our way of reading the Ashraya Tattva. I like to share with you, it came the inspiration. It may take 1 minute. I like to share one section. It's almost at the conclusion of my first book, Inherent or Inherited, when I speak about the Bhagavatam in connection to this name, Srimad Bhagavatam. It says like this. As Gaudiyas embrace the Bhagavatam according to how Mahaprabhu himself embraced it, the result of such an embrace, has taken the form of a remarkable epithet, Srimad Bhagavatam. While the term Bhagavatam denotes something related or belonging to Sri Bhagavan, the esoteric term Srimad points to bhakti in its ultimate expression of personified Mahabhav, Sri Radha. This Mahabhav implies divine frenzy, which represents the definitive converging point of the whole Bhagavatam. In this way, Srimad refers to the madness, Mad, of Radha, Sri, in her loving interaction with Bhagavan Sri Krishna. Thus, we Gaudiya Vaishnavas also call the Srimad Bhagavatam the Radha Bhagavatam, because her name is there, Srimad. But such a concept begs for further development, which plays out in the very apex of the Bhagavatam, according to us, in which Sri Hari contemplates Radha's Mahabhav and becomes greedy to taste it, thus giving rise to Gaur Lila. Here, Braja Krishna drenches himself in the glory of Radha's experience as Mahaprabhu, to such a point that her Mahabhav becomes his, her madness becoming his own. It is in the midst of this pandemonium that Sri Gaur Sundar then relishes Radha's Mahabhav. But the experience overflows from him, splashing whomever is nearby including undeserving passersby such as us. This is just like the wife of a rich man, and she goes mad and suddenly throws all her jewelry from the rooftop, making even the poorest of people rich, though they have no merit whatsoever. And when her millionaire husband sees this, he has no problem at all, since he knows the extent of his own wealth. Correspondingly, the Srimad Bhagavatam ultimately speaks to us about the mad or the madness of Sri Radha for Bhagavan, in which all her jewels of bhakti are indiscriminately delivered in the madness of Mahabhav to one and all, in the topmost expression of compassionate love as Sri Chaitanya. Needless to say, we are those most fortunate redeemed paupers in this magical story. So anyhow, I want to share that with you because it feels like, okay, that's our asrayatat, that's our golden thread. So we as Gaudiya see some clear unfolding and zenith in the Bhagavatam pointing to that. And we can also see that zenith in the very title, as I say, Srimad, in the very word, as we will see, and all throughout. So we'll try to concentrate on this perspective from our Gaudiya lenses throughout our exploration. But at the same time, honoring the Srimad Bhagavatam's universality, we don't want to finish this exploration and making all of you fanatic and fundamentalist Gaudiyas with a superiority complex and trashing and bullying other Vaishnava or other schools, right? But this is the way we'll try to follow the Srimad Bhagavatam's golden thread in our exploration. We'll pay attention to the various clues, that the Srimad Bhagavatam will be dropping all along, if we have the eyes to see, hopefully we have them, and with which we will be constructing this golden thread to keep the message, the narrative coherent, relevant, substantial, and ever-evolving, without rejecting any topic, without rejecting any silver thread in the service of the golden thread, but integrating all of that into a higher synthesis. No need to reject anything. Today in the morning I was re-listening to a conversation I had some years ago with Sri Vatsa Goswami, scholar Vaishnava from the Radharaman tradition, and he said, bhakti is not rejecting, but integrating and transcending. Integrating and transcending. No, not rejecting. Like Mahaprabhu said to Ramananda, eho bahi agi kahar. Okay, that superficial go deeper. Okay, I take that, now it's deeper. Now it's deeper. So a few words I want to share with you today on the golden thread. Because if we don't have in mind there is a golden thread, like I like to say, text without a context becomes a pretext. So a Srimad Bhagavatam without a golden thread, I don't know, becomes a weapon, a dangerous one. We have to be careful what you end up doing with that. And sometimes, of course, people will say, and I'm trying to address some of the potential arguments, but Maharaj, it is said that every verse and every section in the Bhagavatam, and it's every single section and verse and syllable is totally transcendental. Yes, if understood properly in the bigger picture and context of this asraya, this main topic. If you isolate that and try to absolutize one verse describing a list of names of kings, if it's out of context, you are no longer dealing with the real thing here. So, before I conclude, I'd like to share two short verses from the Chaitanya tradition, Chaitanya Charitamrita and Chaitanya Bhagavat, before going to any questions you may have, to conclude pounding this post on today's topic. One verse is found in Madhya Lila, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya Lila, chapter 24, verse 318. Famous verse. Krishna Tulya Bhagavat, Bhibhu Sarva Shroy, Pratishloke Pratyakshare, Nana Artakai. It says, Srimad Bhagavatam is equal to Krishna. As we say before, we can say it's non-different. Who is the supreme shelter and the supreme lord of everything, Bhagavan. In each and every verse of the Bhagavatam and in each and every syllable, there are various meanings. So the Bhagavatam is filled with purport and content in every in-between space, in every syllable. But again, as much as every syllable also implies understood in the context of the asraya. Now, you cannot just take half one syllable randomly from a Bhagavatam and try to make magic out of it. Without the bigger picture, without the actual context. No. That's why, for example, when Jiva Goswami begins his Satsang Dharavas, which revolve all around the Bhagavatam, he starts speaking about which was the intention of Vyasadeva in writing the Bhagavatam. Like, if you don't know the intention of the author of a book, probably you won't get the book. So the same way, yeah, every syllable of the Bhagavatam have full layer of meaning. But what's the intention of every verse, every syllable of the whole work? We have to keep that in context. And one verse from the Chaitanya Bhagavat. Since we mentioned Mahaprabhu a minute ago, let's conclude honoring some of his main biographies. Chaitanya Bhagavat, Madhya Lila, chapter 22, verses 13-14. It says, according to all the revealed scriptures, the Srimad Bhagavatam is inconceivable beyond mundane understanding. Its meaning cannot be understood either by scholarship or penance. One who is not a devotee of Krishna, no matter how great scholar he may be, will never understand Srimad Bhagavatam. So, verses like this are not exclusionary, okay? Don't feel triggered. That say, oh, the verse says, if you don't are not a devotee, you cannot get the book. So it's only for those who belong to this elite club. The point says, if you're not a devotee of Krishna, you won't understand the Bhagavatam. Why? Because if you're not a lover, you probably won't understand a book about love. Without love, you cannot understand the Bhagavatam, without the willingness to love, because the book is all about love. Love is the golden thread, as we say before. So that's the intention of verses like this, which may seem to be exclusionary. No, no, it's just making the point that this book is all about love. That's the golden thread. So don't lose sight of that golden thread, okay? That's as much as I could pound the post today, trying to make clear what's the golden thread, the essential message, the living pulse, the living heart of the Bhagavatam. So I'll put my sharing to rest. And if there are any questions, as I say before, you are invited to send them by written form in the chat to my personal private message or in the public starting with an interrogation mark. I beg that you may be concise in the question and clear so we can have time and space for addressing other questions. So now it's my turn to go to the chat and see if there is anything here. Yes, there is something. Okay, Bhadra. I appreciate souls being attracted to Krishna in Dwarka, Mathura, Vaikuntha, etc. I understand Srila Prabhupada said that by constitution, every soul is a Vaishnava, devotee of Vishnu. This being the case, how can some be attracted to Brahman as an ultimate place of rest or as their cup of tea? So, well, I'm not the best person to speak for that because that's not my cup of tea. So you may need to ask someone that is willing to drink that cup of tea. But we should begin with the basic acknowledgement that that's described in the scripture, that's described in the Bhagavatam. Brahman is one of the different facets of non-dual reality at Vaigyan Tattva. And it can be attained by a certain sadhana, Gyan Yoga. That say, we will say in our tradition, that Gyan Yoga has to have some, at some point, some admixture of bhakti for it to bear fruit. So in that sense, someone who attains Brahman, Brahma Sayujya, which is one of the five types of mukti, no? So the Bhagavatam describes five types of mukti, right? One of them being Brahma Sayujya or Ekatva in the Bhagavatam's name. So if it's mukti, means you attain that and you don't fall from that. That's a permanent situation in transcendence. If you fall from mukti, that's not mukti by definition. So it is said that if, in order to attain that, we will say you have to have you have to invoke bhakti at one point to make jnana fruitful. So in that sense, that bhakti incorporation makes you, on some degree, a Vaishnava. There's a presence of bhakti. Though in Brahman, you won't be actively serving. You will be kind of a servant who is taking a nap, a long one. Right? But a servant who is sleeping is still a servant, right? If you go in a palace and a servant is taking a nap, you won't say, He's not a servant during the moment of nap. He's still a servant, but taking some rest. The thing is that in Brahman, the rest has no end. But still, we will say there is some bhakti that took that soul to that level of realization in Brahman. And they have their particular samskars that make them predisposed to that particular attainment. Again, it may be difficult for us to find attraction to that if it's not our cup of tea. And that's an invitation to be open to acknowledge that, because that's in Shastra. We cannot contradict that. And respect and honor that, even if it's not our cup of tea, without the need of converting them to my side of the story, without the need of feeling that I need to be converted to their cup of tea, and having that open acknowledgement. So a few words in that connection. You say, I wonder then if Srila Prabhupada's statement, everyone is constitutionally a Vaishnava, is an example of Saka Chandra Nyay. I will say that, again, and I know not everyone will agree with me, but if Prabhupada said everyone is a Vaishnava, it speaks mostly about the potential of the jiva, right? In potential, everyone is a Vaishnava. Because a Vaishnava is someone who has big bhakti for Vishnu, for a form of the divine. But if we go to the conversation about whether bhakti is inherent in the jiva or not, and we somehow conclude that it's not, then how can we say that every jiva is a Vaishnava? Well, but in potential, that's there. And I'll stop my answer there, because I've just opened a can of worms, probably. Let's see. Trivikram Prabhu, who will stay in New Zealand still. He says, there is a saying, begin with the end in mind. Okay. In the first verse of the Srimad Bhagavatam 111, Srila Prabhupada mentions the Adirasa. Could you please put this in context? I've been personally belittled for asking this question by my then guru in Bhagavatam class in public. Anyhow. So, yeah, this is based on Bhishmanath Chakravarti Thakur's purport, actually. Because Srila Prabhupada, he has no shyness in acknowledging that big part of his own purports are derived by Bhishmanath Chakravarti Thakur's purports. So it's important for us to acknowledge the presence of tradition there, right? And not to over-glorify someone isolated from their ancestry. Like Prabhupada himself dedicates his Srimad Bhagavad Gita's commentary to Baladev Vidyabhushan. In big part, why? Because Baladev Vidyabhushan wrote the commentary on the Gita from which Prabhupada is drawing a lot. Not stealing, drawing like it's natural in the tradition to do. So similarly with the Bhagavatam, he's doing a similar way of honoring with Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. So many of the things that Prabhupada says in his purports are mentioned by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, this being the case, one of those. And actually, as I said, I think I mentioned that in the first class, that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's purport or commentary on verse 111 of the Srimad Bhagavatam is quite extensive. He gives like 3 or 4 layers of meaning of the verse, talking in general about Krishna, talking in Krishna in connection to Radha, talking about Mahaprabhu, like how the same verse could be read in different ways. As we said, there's a famous series of 100 commentaries to the first verse of the Bhagavatam only. So you can read the same verse in 100 different ways. So so this Adirasa will mean like the original Adirasa, and it's connected to the beginning of the verse, right? Janmadiyasya. So Janmadiyasya means he from whom Janma and other things are born. But again, you can, Sanskrit lends itself to interpretation. That's the nuance and the flexibility of Sanskrit, is that if you know how to do it, you can read the same words in so many different ways, depending on context. It's a very context-based language, which is very sensitive. So one way you can read the word Adi is to mean Adi Rasa, and Adi Rasa generally is tied to the notion of Madhurya Rasa. And then Krishna there is connected to Sri Radha, and therefore, in that case, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, as Prabhupada himself, made the case that, okay, right from verse 1, and before even the verse 1 from the title, as I showed, there you have it. You have Krishna, you have Radha, you have their loving interaction, their romantic intimacy and the sweetness of that. So it's right there from the beginning, And it's right there till the end. Again, it's in the beginning, preparing the building ground for that, reaching the zenith overtly in 10th canto. But then you go to 11th canto, there is a lot of verses that point back to that. And you go to 12th canto and it all converges into Gaur Lila, which is all about Radha Bhav, right? The whole 10th canto seems to be about how ugly Kali Yuga is, if you read the 12th canto outside of context. But if you keep in mind all that has been said so far, again, the text has to keep some coherence. It's not like you have all this beauty of the Rasa Leela and this and that and the afterthought on that, and then Kali Yuga is the worst, and that's the end of the book. Good luck, you Kali Yugins. No, it's mentioning some of the challenges we'll find in Kali Yuga, but then it's concluding on how Kali Yuga is the best possible age and starts to praise Harinam Sankirtan and Mahaprabhu and the Bhagavatam ends on that high note in the last verse in ecstasy. Now Sankirtanam Jasya Sarva Papa Pranasanam Pranamo Sukha Samanas Tannamami Harim Param. That's the end of the Bhagavatam. And it leaves us at the feet of Gaur Lila. And the main reason for Gaur Lila is Krishna wants to taste Radha Bhav, Adi Rasa, which is right there at verse 1. So that's a way we can, as you say, begin with the end in mind, or end with the beginning in mind, if you will, also. Upakram upasamhara in Sanskrit. What said in the beginning, what said at the end, that kind of gives hints of what's in the middle, in between the beginning and the end. So that's a way of we can understand this golden thread as well. Thank you. Okay, I'm seeing a lot of messages. Let's see if we can reach time. I have to be a little bit concise, as you can see. We have the Saturday satsang for indulging in longer questions and answers, if you need. Sweta Dviparadika. And I'm just pressing buttons. I'm not following any order here, so I don't know how they are coming. Since bhakti is beyond mukti, doesn't it naturally make us see bhakti to be better than mukti? Though not everyone might like to hear that. Yeah, why not? For me, bhakti is better than mukti. For someone who wants mukti in Brahman, that will be a different opinion. And I have to honor that because there is place for that in eternity. So how much can I disagree with eternity? Right? Or someone, I can say, well, for me, the sweetness and intimacy of Krishna bhakti is unique. But if I found a Sri Vaishnava who wants to worship Lakshmi Narayan in Aishwarya Bhav, that's great. That's not great for me. I mean, it's great, not for applicable to me, that's not my call. But for them, it's the best thing, great, I celebrate with you. And there's place for that in eternity. So who am I to downplay an attainment that is perpetual in transcendence? So yeah, we tend to see mukti as something that still entails a personal desire. I want to be liberated. Somehow it's still something that has to do with me. And we will see that eventually as the Bhagavatam progresses, liberation is not only merging in Brahman. There are many devotional liberations. Salokya, Samipya, Sarupya, Sarshti. And the Bhagavatam, in comparison to the love of Vrindavan, downplays even all those forms of liberation, which are devotional mukti. Again, it's not that we are criticizing them, we are just saying that's not our cup of tea. But that's more like axiological, I will use some nerdy word here, that's more axiological than ontological. Ontological, all forms of attainment in transcendence are in one sense the same. They're all eternal, perfect. Axiological has more to do with what's my favorite, my personal experience. So I will say this is the best for me. But as Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says, every devotee will think my connection to the Absolute is the best, and everyone is correct. So that's pretty open-minded statement. Let's see, a few other comments. Mukunda is asking me if I live in an ashram in North Carolina. Okay, That's part of the buyout analysis, so it's not off topic. We have a blank page for us to fill with our life story of the button, so that's part of the narrative. I'm currently here. I don't know what it means to say I live somewhere. I don't know if I know how to answer that question because I travel quite a lot. But I spend a few months here. So I'm here. I'll be here, I don't know for how long, at least for a few months, though I may travel in between. So yeah, I don't have a fixed residence during this last few years. What else? Bishaka from Sweden. It seems like reading or studying the Srimad Bhagavatam is an art. Beautiful. Put, yeah. Because you have to understand how the themes are related to the Ashraya. Some are expert at picking verses that illuminate the point they want to emphasize, and the points being off topic or a detail in relation to the Ashraya. but that was the end of the message. But I will say yes, it's an art. That's why also it's so important to learn scripture from sadhu, from guru, basically. Diksha guru, siksha guru, but again, our parampara is sometimes called Bhagavat parampara. And we are to learn the Bhagavat in parampara. No, it's not that just pick the book and get your realization. Probably you won't get much, or you may get confused, or you may get something you think is a realization, but it's your own. Because we come to the book with our own samskars, with our own presuppositions, with our own assumptions. And as I said before, and we will talk about that in a few classes, we should change the approach. It's not I'm coming to the book and I will read the book. I will open the book. No, it's let the book open me. Let the book read me. Let me realize that the book is not just a book. It's not a passive product for me to consume. Now, studying Shastra is not like going to a supermarket and eating a chocolate. I'm consuming the product as I wish. No. It's the willingness to open that and be opened by the act of opening it and being read by the act of reading it. That's why scriptural study is called Swadhyaya. Swadhyaya means self-reflection, introspection. So yeah, we need guidance for that. It's a journey unto itself. It's an art. We can try by ourselves, but that's not what the Bhagavatam teaches, as we will see in the Bhagavatam itself. Over and over again, the importance of sadhu sangha, of connection with guides, spiritual directors is there. So that's the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam itself is teaching us how to study the Bhagavatam. Thank you. John is saying, thank you. Bhaiji, dear brother, thank you. Okay. So now I'm going to the main chat. I was going to the private messages. Let's see. There's one question from Kanupriya, and so far it seems to be the last one, and we are almost on time, so let's see. Kanupriya says, I never heard before that Srimad can be translated as the beautiful Radha's madness. Where does this come from? What are other translations of the title? Maybe I missed the point because I got a call in between. Yeah, of course. Of course, there are many ways. Again, as I say, Sanskrit is a very generous language in how much it lends itself to multiple meanings. And it's very unsettling, very humbling, because we tend to go to a word and just ascribe only one possible translation and meaning, and that's it. And Sanskrit does not allow to do that. It's all context depending. Like if I say the word Atman, and you may say, oh, that's the soul. And I will say, it depends. First of all, it depends what you understand as the soul, right? Because if you come from a Christian background, you may think the soul is created out of clay or out of nothing. It has one life. And other things that do not align with what we will understand as soul. But even beyond that, the word Atman can mean mind, can mean body, can mean God, depending the context. So Sanskrit is very unsettling. That if you bring a separate word outside of a context and you ask me what does it mean, I cannot tell you what does it mean, because we need the context to know what it means. So that's a very deep lesson, which is Reality does not exist in isolation. We always need to consider context to make sense of everything or anything. So when we say Srimad Bhagavatam, we can give endless meanings. So there is not like only this meaning, only these few meanings. But in connection to your question, I personally heard the meaning, the possible reading of Srimad Bhagavatam as the madness of Sri made by Atul Krishna Goswami. Atul Krishna Goswami is a scholar from the Sri Radharaman temple. He already passed, Gaudiya Vaishnava, Acharya from the Radharaman tradition. So I heard that from Srila Bhakti Swarup Sridhar Maharaj, who studied with Atul Krishna Goswami. He studied Bhagavatam with Atul Krishna Goswami. So I heard from Bhakti Swarup Sridhar Maharaj. I'm friends with him. So he mentioned that to me on a few occasions. So that's one of many possible readings. Again, it's not just a play of words. It's a possible meaning, right? And I will say that that's more than enough. No, I will say rather than just being curious about, okay, which are other possible meanings? No, stay with that one for enough time. There is a lot there. And I gave another possible meaning. If we take Sri as beautiful and mad as madness, the beautiful madness for Bhagavan, and it can be also applicable to us. No, we are not Radha. So in this case, we can speak about how the Bhagavatam is portraying a list of examples of living devotees that show what it means to fall in love madly with God. It's mirroring back our potential in bhakti, basically. So yeah, there's a lot in titles. Rohini Sutta Prabhu says, the beautiful stories of the Lord is another title, at least for me. Yeah, why not? As long as the word beautiful is there, I have no problem. Bhakti Rasa says, they wouldn't be able to rest there forever. Of course, this is a commentary to something I said 20 minutes ago. They wouldn't be able to rest there forever if they didn't love it there. Yeah. Since love takes two, the Vishaya and the Ashraya, my pun intellect can't understand how one can eternally love it there, Brahman. Well, Brahman is another one. I mean, there are two. You may not have an awareness of the two, but we wouldn't say that if a soul, and that's something we differ with from Advaita Vedanta. Advaita Vedanta will say, strict Advaita Vedanta, like hardcore, old school, grassroots followers of Shankaracharya, will say, there's no merging in Brahman, because there's nobody to merge in Brahman. There's only Brahman. It's just that you are not aware of that. So there's not two, there's not a second person. That's their take. Our take will be, no, there is an individual soul, and the individual soul chooses to merge into Brahman, but their individuality remains eternal. But they are just not aware of their individuality. But still there are two, soul and Brahman. So it may not be a falling in love with another as we generally think of falling in love with another, but still there are two in eternity, though we may not have that experience in that particular situation. Okay, I think I've tried to address all the questions or comments you had, so, and we are almost on time. So before we conclude, that was a good series. Let's spend a few more minutes, hopefully. And of course, the class will be uploaded later in YouTube today, so feel free to go there again if you need to go through something. A little homework for this rest of the week for those who will like. Again, reflection-like, and the homework is the following. In your personal experience, where do you see the golden thread of divine love appearing in the Srimad Bhagavatam? Or in the bhakti tradition in general? I mean, it could be a verse, it could be a story, it could be a character that for you embodies this golden thread which has tried to describe today. It could be a particular teaching that expresses divine love in a way that is meaningful to you. All the idea of this homework is to keep it personal, make it relatable to you. So in your personal experience, where do you see this golden thread of divine love appearing in the Bhagavatam, as much as you have had a chance to study the Srimad Bhagavatam? Or in the bhakti tradition in general, it may not be the book, it may be some practice of bhakti traditions, an experience you've had, some particular person you are related to. Again, could be a verse, a story, a character, a teaching, a moment that somehow expresses divine love in a meaningful way to you. You can reflect upon that. You can write, journal upon that. And before concluding, give me 10 more minutes and we will invite you to our classical breakout rooms, where we're inviting you to also have some deep breakthrough, breaking open, if it's required, breaking down for the sake of breakthrough. I will share a brief prompt for that, which will be basically, if today's class, did today's class change or clarify your understanding of what the golden thread of the Bhagavatam might be? And if so, how? So that will be basically the prompt for the breakout rooms. No? If today's class in any way changed or clarified or challenged your understanding of what's the golden thread or the living heart essential message of the Bhagavatam, and if that's the case, how? So before we go there, I'll put the recording to rest, and to close it in a gentle way, I'll conclude with a brief praise. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai, Srimad Mahaprabhu Ki Jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan Ki Jai, Gaur Bhaktavrinda Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Bo. Okay, thank you very much, and Bhaktarasa will invite you now to the breakout room for a few minutes so we continue in Sangha churning together, getting further insights, and see you back in a few minutes to say goodbye.